case 21-3981 and 21-3991, Steve Snyder Hill et al. Versus the Ohio State University, and Timothy Moxley et al. Versus the Ohio State University. Argument not to exceed 30 minutes per side. Mr. Mazzell, you may proceed for the appellants when ready. Please announce your rebuttal time.
May it please the court, Ilan Mazzell for the plaintiff's appellants, and we've reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
A statute of limitations begins to run only once a reasonable person knows, or in the exercise of due diligence, should have known both his injury and the cause of that injury. That's this court's holding in Bishop, in Cote, Fonseca, D'Ambrosio, Parsons, and Hogan. It's also the holding of the 1st, 2nd, 5th, 7th, 9th, 11th, and D.C. circuits. So consider an 18-year-old getting his first physical from a university team doctor. OSU has the burden on its affirmative statute of limitations defense to prove that that student, that teenager, knew or should have known first that his uncomfortable medical exam was actually a sexual abuse by a university doctor, and that OSU itself enabled and caused the abuse. And what does that mean in the Title IX context? Waymer teaches us and Getzer teaches us that means that an official with authority to take corrective action had actual notice of the harassment, that the school's response was clearly unreasonable, and that the school's deliberate indifference caused that sexual abuse. Now, I want to start with causation, because none of the plaintiffs, not one of them, knew or had reason to know that OSU caused their sexual abuse. This is a case against OSU, not Dr. Strauss.
Let's take a look at that for a minute, because the statement that the university, if an official of the university with authority to take corrective action knew about the abuse, then there's knowledge. And certainly the coaches all knew about it. They had the authority to take action, and everybody knew about it.
Actually, Judge, I think that's not the case. The Sixth Circuit ruled in the Kesterson case, 967F3rd519, that knowledge by a coach or an assistant coach is not sufficient to establish notice for Title IX purposes. That is the holding of Kesterson. And there is not a single plaintiff, not a single plaintiff knew that the general counsel was aware, or a vice president was aware, or that any administrator was aware. That is nowhere, anywhere in the complaint, and it is OSU's burden on this affirmative defense to prove, taking every inference in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, that those plaintiffs were aware of that, and they were not. And I just want to start with, you know, why is this plausible? It's plausible for a number of reasons. Let's start with 2018. OSU hired a law firm to determine, quote, whether the university even had such knowledge of allegations against Strauss. That's paragraph 274 of the Snyder Hill complaint, 216 of the Moxley complaint. So OSU hired a firm, spent over $6.2 million, 12 months, reviewed 825 boxes, and interviewed 520 witnesses just to answer the question, did it know? So how was it?
Was it publicly known when OSU hired this law firm what the reasons for hiring the law firm were and that the law firm was hired? Was that all publicly known? Because I'm curious about the law firm was hired in approximately April of 2018, and then the lawsuit is filed a few months later, right? At least in the Snyder Hill case.
Right, and it was in April 2018 when OSU made a public announcement that it was investigating potential serial sexual abuse by Dr. Strauss that we say, that's the moment. That's the moment when the plaintiffs knew or should have known that they might have a claim. And very similar to the Hughes v. Vanderbilt case, Sixth Circuit case, widespread press coverage can trigger a plaintiff's discovery. Same in Lozano, the Baylor University made findings of fact. That triggered accrual, same with Jameson, same with Doe.
So for all of the plaintiffs then, the trigger was the April 2018 hiring?
Yeah, I think April 2018 was the trigger. That's the best argument OSU has to trigger accrual.
I know this is probably taking you outside of the way you were organizing this, but the Moxley plaintiffs, did they file in 2021?
Yes, but there was American Pipe Tolling, because it's a parallel Garrett case, class action case, which told any statute of limitations, and that was filed a week before the Snyder Hill case.
So, no question,
okay, there, Judge.
Thank you.
The facts related to OSU's culpability were within OSU's exclusive control. Just like the Supreme Court said in U.S. v. Kubrick, facts about causation may be in the control of the defendants. And Kubrick pointed out that if you don't know the injury or its cause, statute of limitations does not accrue. And I want to point out the First Circuit case in Ouellette, which I think is probably the most on-point case here. Ouellette held that even if a student or a plaintiff had some reason to suspect that OSU, that the defendant had caused the abuse, it is still the defendant's burden to prove that a diligent investigation would have uncovered sufficient information to allow plaintiff to bring suit, and that that's not possible, quote, where a defendant took steps to cover up its involvement. That is exactly this case. OSU did everything possible to cover up its own knowledge and complicity in this abuse. It falsified Strauss's performance reviews, whitewashed the sexual abuse. They admit, this is paragraph 227, that for legal reasons, we would never mention a serious allegation against the physician on their evaluation form. They failed to disclose Strauss's abuse to the medical board, to law enforcement, to the public, to students. They shredded his employment file. They destroyed patient health records. They lied to Mr. Snyder Hill when he said, had anyone else ever been abused? They failed to discipline him for 2 decades. When they finally had a disciplinary hearing, they hid it, and then they hid the findings, and then they let him work at the university for 2 more years, and then they gave him emeritus status, and then years later they lauded him as being a great doctor for students. They did everything possible to create a giant wall around their own complicity, a wall of concealment, a wall of silence, and on the other side of that wall are these students who, first of all, are somehow supposed to know not only that they're sexually abused, but that OSU knew about it at the highest levels and were deliberately indifferent to it. And even if they tried to climb that wall, there is no way they could have learned what OSU knew, because OSU did everything to conceal it. And so OSU is coming to this court, hat in hand, and saying, please reward us for our mendacity. Please reward us for lying and concealing and obfuscating for 40 years, because we were so successful at lying and concealing the abuse and our response and our knowledge that we managed to get past the 2-year statute of limitations. That's the rule they're asking. They are asking this court, their rule encourages universities to cover up abuse. And they're doing that in the context of a statute that the Supreme Court has said repeatedly should be interpreted broadly to eradicate discrimination. Their entire policy is to cover up discrimination and then say it's too late. Their rule is, heads they win, tails we lose. Because if a student in 1985 had gone to a lawyer and said, I think I might have been sexually abused, you know, can I bring a case? There was no way they could have brought that case. The lawyer would have said, well, did administrators know? I have no idea. Right? Were they deliberately indifferent? What was their response? I have no idea. That would have been a motion to dismiss and probably a Rule 11 sanction. So plaintiffs,
they could have brought us a state tort action, though.
Perhaps they could have brought a state tort action if they knew they were sexually abused against Mr. Strauss. But in terms of a title,
if they knew they were sexually abused, you mean these people are saying they didn't know they were sexually abused?
Some did and some didn't, Your Honor. And I want to get to that issue in a moment. But as to this Title IX claim, the key is that a Title IX claim could not be brought against Dr. Strauss, only against the university. And the question is, did these plaintiffs have the knowledge to bring a Title IX claim against the university? That's the question before this court. And Ouellette, this is a post-Rutkiski case, First Circuit. The plaintiff was sexually abused by a police officer as a teenager. He reported it to the chief of the department. But what he didn't know until decades later was that the department, the chief, were aware of multiple sexual abuse complaints by others. And, you know, that that defendant, that there was a Monell claim, pattern of practice Monell claim that the plaintiff brought, and that defendant said, too late, statute of limitations, you knew you were sexually abused. And the First Circuit said, no, not at all. Because the plaintiff was not armed with the necessary factual predicate to file suit against the department. The Monell facts weren't there.
And are there any Title IX cases that go the other way? Then you mentioned a number of circuits going your way. Are there any that have gone the other way?
Not that have analyzed the discovery rule, Judge. I think they cited one Sixth Circuit case that applied a Kentucky law of accrual, which is a mistake. It should be a federal law of accrual. And this circuit has held repeatedly that Section 1983, Title IX, similar analysis for the discovery rule. Neither statute has a textual statute of limitations. And in the 1983 context, this court has held that the discovery rule applies on multiple occasions, and a number of other circuits have held that. Ouellette held that. Petrovsky held that. I just want to say one final thing about Ouellette, which is that the court held that a lawyer would not have advised that plaintiff, who knew he was sexually abused, to file a lawsuit. Would not likely have survived the motion to dismiss, and a reasonable jury could find that Ouellette had no duty to diligently investigate. This court has held repeatedly in Riardic and Cutter that the question of a plaintiff's knowledge or what they should have known is a fact question. We have not had discovery. This is a motion to dismiss. It is their burden. Somehow from the face of the complaint, they are trying to prove to this court that all these plaintiffs, all these students, all these teenagers knew or should have known about OSU's own culpability, notwithstanding their own concealment. There is nothing in the complaint that says that.
Well, what about, I know that there are many, many plaintiffs here and they have different facts, but there is one plaintiff who said that he complained to a coach and the coach said, you should not pursue this because bad things are going to happen to you if you pursue this. So how would you address that particular individual's situation?
So for a plaintiff like that, and of course most plaintiffs are not like that, but for a plaintiff right. like that, that would not in any way create notice for a pre-assault claim. In short, if that student goes to a coach and says, I was sexually abused, first of all, the coach is not high enough, according to the Kesterson case, to provide notice to the university. But even if the coach were high enough, that wouldn't defeat a pre-assault claim, which would rely on the plaintiff knowing that before he was abused, not after, but before he was abused, high-level administrators were aware of sexual abuse and were deliberately indifferent to it. So there really is not a single plaintiff, and the defendants have pointed to none, that as a matter of law, taking every inference in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, I knew or should have known of OSU's causal role.
So on a pre-assault claim, the theory is that the various people at OSU knew about Strauss and what he was doing and did nothing to stop it. But do you need to show that a high-up person knew about it as opposed to just the coaches?
Yes.
Okay, and what allegations do you have that a high-up person knew about it as opposed to just the coaches? Because you certainly have a lot of allegations that it was common knowledge among the athletes and the coaches and the people in sort of the athletics part of the university.
Sure. And it's a large complaint, but I think at paragraph 2,566 and maybe elsewhere, we list some of the high-level administrators who did know. General counsel, various vice presidents. Students didn't know that they knew, but they did know. And I should point out that, you know, there is no merits-based motion here. OSU has not brought a motion to dismiss on the merits, only on statute of limitation. So if perhaps one day summary judgment, they want to argue that people at the top didn't know, I suppose they can make the argument, but discovery will not bear that out, even based on what we know now. I think there's overwhelming evidence that at very high levels, this university knew about Strauss and did not only did nothing about him to stop his abuse, but covered up what they did know. I do want to mention also the...
You know, is there anything in the record that sort of explains why the university, and be understandable if not, since you haven't had discovery, continued to... permit permit the abuse after the university knew that Dr. Strauss was engaging in this abuse? Is there anything in the record that explains that?
Well, I'll start with paragraph 227 of the complaint. This is Dr. Grace who said, and we had a couple of depositions, actually, pre-motion to dismiss. Dr. Grace, who said under oath, quote, for legal reasons, we would never mention a serious allegation against a physician on their evaluation form. So I think discovery will show that they were trying to avoid a lawsuit like this. They were trying to avoid accountability. They were trying to prevent a scandal from being known. And unfortunately, they are not alone. We know this is what the University of Michigan did, Michigan State did, Penn State did. A number of universities, unfortunately, don't do the right thing. And if they prevail in this appeal, they will never do the right thing, because they will always just write out the statute of limitations through their own lying and concealment. And
it is perplexing why they continue to employ this doctor.
It's shocking. I agree it's perplexing, and it's shocking. And I very much look forward, if and when we get to discovery, to asking, under oath, some of these high-level executives, what were you thinking? It's extraordinary that they would allow this monster to have access in sports team after sports team and university health services. And why did they keep promoting him, year after year? It's shocking. And yet that's what they did. And I appreciate we're getting beyond the...
Yeah, so does your case really hinge on, A, the discovery rule applying, and B, your particular interpretation of the discovery rule?
So the case does hinge on the discovery rule applying, with the exception of a few plaintiffs who also have equitable tolling, such as Mr. Snyder-Hill, who Dr. Grace told him he was the only one who was ever sexually abused. He relied on that to his detriment. He thought, I'm the only one, and didn't bring suit. So there are a few plaintiffs, and this is in our briefing, who have equitable tolling and separate doctrine. But as for the rest of them, yes, the discovery rule, we do rely on the discovery rule.
And on the particular interpretation that it is discovery of the injury and the cause.
Well, that is the interpretation, Judge. Well, I should say two things about that. First, that is the interpretation of this circuit and seven other circuits. But as to many of the plaintiffs, they also didn't know that they were injured. And I can address that briefly. We don't need to reach this issue because of the causation question, but there are at least 15 reasons why many of the plaintiffs didn't know they were sexually abused. Their youth, their inexperience with medical exams, their lack of medical training, the doctor-patient contacts. This is not priests, this is not teachers, these are doctors. We go to doctors, we take off our clothes, they touch us. Sometimes they penetrate patients. That is normal. That is why OSU's law firm itself in 2018, when they were investigating sexual abuse by Strauss, deemed it, quote, essential to consult with suitably qualified medical experts, even to discern whether Strauss's examinations were medically necessary. So a law firm in 2018, which is investigating sexual abuse by this man, deemed it not advisable or helpful, but essential to consult with medical experts to determine was this abuse or not, because it's not a clear question. Dr. Lombardo, the OSU's head team physician, admitted under oath, you need to be trained in medicine to recognize sexual abuse by a doctor. Dr. Grace, Director of Student Health Services, testified, quote, you need to consult medical experts to recognize sexual abuse by a doctor. So sexual abuse by a doctor is different, and that's why the National Center for Victims of Crime, in their amicus brief at page 6, noted that many victims never seek to question the behavior of the doctors. That's why patients who saw Dr. Dehan, Dr. Gupta, Dr. Rios, Dr. Bardo, Dr. Tyndall at USC, Dr. Haddon at Columbia, Dr. Anderson at the University of Michigan, Dr. Nasser at Michigan State, thousands of them all failed to recognize sexual abuse, even when those doctors were groping their breasts, touching or fondling their genitals, penetrating them, even in front of those students' parents. So there are many, many patients who do not recognize sexual abuse by a doctor. When you go to see a recognized university team doctor, you are not thinking, I'm about to be sexually abused. And just to take an example, or a couple of examples, the Snyder Hill complaint, paragraph 724, plaintiff, I'll call by the initials JF. He got a physical. Dr. Strauss held his genitals for an extended period of time. He felt uncomfortable and, quote, felt that something was odd about Strauss's examination, paragraph 736. Something was odd. And now OSU comes, you know, 40 years later and says, as a matter of law, he should have known he was sexually abused because he felt something was odd. That it's an astonishing proposition when it's their burden on a statute of limitations defense. And the district court, unfortunately, did not analyze a single allegation by a single plaintiff as if they didn't exist. Just swept it all aside. There was no analysis at all. And I simply held that, well, if students experienced some sort of emotional distress, they must have known they were sexually abused. But the National Crime Victims Amicus Brief says at page 4, quote, one may experience emotional distress without understanding what caused such an injury. One can be sexually abused and not realize it. And that's what the psychologist brief said in their amicus brief, page 9. Sexual assault can result in serious consequences, regardless of whether people acknowledge to themselves that they were sexually victimized. So many of these plaintiffs, not all, but many of them did not realize and could not have realized they were actually sexually abused.
But for the ones who did realize, you said you would get to that.
Yes. For the ones who did realize, they did not know the cause of the abuse. So for the vast majority of plaintiffs, OSU fails.
Well, they didn't know the cause. You mean they didn't know the involvement of the university.
Is that right.
What it is?
That's right. They didn't know. They had no basis to know.
That the university knew beforehand.
That's right.
That Strauss was assaulting students.
Didn't know that the university knew beforehand, didn't know about their a clearly unreasonable or deliberately indifferent response, didn't know that that failure by the university was a cause of their own sexual abuse. And that's what they would have had to know under Ouellette, under Petrosky, under Barrett. That's what they would have had to know in order to have the factual predicate to bring a claim. And the reason they didn't know, or a large reason they didn't know, is because OSU made it impossible for them to know. It was a deliberate choice by this university.
You certainly have going for you the egregious conduct of the doctor and the egregious conduct of the university. My only worry is a little bit about the discovery rule as it applies to this case, because even in 2018, if you had asked students, when did you realize you had a Title IX deliberate indifference claim against somebody, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. I mean, you'd have to have gone to a lawyer or something to know that on the thing. It's not like finding a sponge 5 years after the operation is over. Those cases are easy. But these, I'm a little troubled by having this could go on 100 years, and I think it's safe to say, you mentioned Nassar and all the other cases and whatnot, that that's when the whole awareness of this got to be, and also the whole awareness of the multi-million dollars in damages that are possibly available in cases like this. So I am no sympathy for the university, but that's this case. I'm just a little worried about how you state the discovery rule so that it doesn't forever remove any time limit at all.
Sure, and I'm glad you raised that, Judge Guy. The courts have distinguished between lacking knowledge of the legal elements of a claim and lacking knowledge of the factual predicate for a claim. And it is, I think, unexceptional that widespread press coverage or a university report is precisely the sort of thing that, again, in Hughes, Lozano, Jameson, the Pasadena case, precisely the sort of thing that can trigger, if not actual knowledge, at least a reasonable basis to know of the university's culpability. So I guess my final point, before, as I see my time is up before rebuttal, is that we should not let the university profit off its own deception. That's the only reason why it's taken this long. Had they done the right thing, had they followed the law, in the 70s or the 80s, then the lawsuit could have been brought then, but they didn't. And they actively concealed their misconduct, and I've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, may it please the court. I am Mike Carpenter, and I'm here for defendant Appellee Ohio State University. And I'm asking this court to affirm the trial court decision below. I do so out of respect for one of our bedrock principles, statute of limitations, but I would do not ask this out of any disrespect for the claims and the allegations of the plaintiffs in both of these appeals or any of the other appeals appearing before this court. I would be remiss if I did not state that Ohio State has condemned the actions of Dr. Strauss and has apologized for them. When it was brought to the university's attention in April of 2018, as Your Honor, Judge Moore indicated, it took immediate action. It reported the allegations to the police. It commissioned the independent external Perkins Coie report. It made efforts to reconcile with the Strauss survivors, providing them with free counseling service.
You know, isn't it the theory of your opposing counsel that the university knew long before 2018? It's just that the controversy blew up in 2018. You said you're stating that the university didn't know anything until 2018, which and maybe that's not so, but perhaps discovery can delve into that. But isn't there information in the record that, or at least allegations, credible allegations, that the university knew long before 2018?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is the university of today has taken these actions in response to when it was brought to its attention in 2018. And so I would be remiss if I did not point that out.
But there's argument that the university knew long before 2018.
Your Honor, they have alleged that there was a complete and present cause of action in existence from 1978 to 1998. And under the occurrence rule, by the United States Supreme Court, and the occurrence rule applied by this circuit, and the occurrence rule that has been applied in every other circuit that has applied it, this cause of action accrued 20 to 40 years ago. And I think what's happened here today, and I understand Judge Guy is talking about the egregious conduct back 20 to 40 years ago by Ohio State, but we have conflated the accrual rule with the cause of action.
But that's what we're trying to find out, whether we're going to proceed based on the occurrence rule or the discovery rule. And that's really what you could help us with in trying to reach some decision about that. If it's the discovery, then you have a much more difficult time here.
We think we prevail under either rule, but let me go to the occurrence rule first, Your Honor. Under the occurrence rule, which the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized in the Wallace case.
In which case?
The Wallace versus Cato case, Your Honor. The U.S. Supreme Court, by the way, has never applied a discovery rule to a Title IX case. In the Wallace versus Cato case, the court applied an occurrence rule to a 1983 case. And so the U.S. Supreme Court, that we would be going against U.S. Supreme Court.
Was the issue of whether the occurrence rule should apply a litigated issue in Wallace?
It was litigated, not directly, but in terms of when the cause of action accrued, Your Honor. And it accrued when all of the causes of action, the elements of the cause of action were in existence, whether the plaintiffs knew it or not. And the plaintiffs in this case have acknowledged that if the occurrence rule was applied, the statute of limitations accrued here 20 to 40 years ago, and the cause of action was present and active at that time, it should have been brought in as time barred.
But the Supreme Court didn't expressly say that the discovery rule could not be used or could never be used in a Title IX case. If they had said that, we maybe we wouldn't be here. We know the answer that counsel on both sides are arguing today, but Supreme Court hasn't really expressly addressed that.
Supreme Court has not said directly that Title IX cases are controlled by the occurrence rule, but it has talked about Title IX in the context of being a contract type of action. Just on April 28th of this year, to provide the court some help in the Cummings versus Premier Rehab case, the Supreme Court distinguished that there are four types of discrimination acts under the United States: the Rehabilitation Act, the Affordable Care Act, Title VI, and Title IX, and said all of those claims of discrimination arise from a contract-based action. And in doing so, the court indicated that contract-based actions are the way you look for purposes of damages. They expressly state,
who would be the contracting parties in this case?
The university and the federal government. And they said, this is why you're not allowed to obtain punitive damages in a Title IX case. And the Supreme Court said in this case in April, likewise, that emotional damages, distress, are not available to Title IX plaintiffs because the university needs to know their exposure risk before they take the federal funds. So under this contract type theory, as the Supreme Court has announced just a few months ago, what we look to under contract law, when does the breach occur? And that is similar in the occurrence rule, Your Honor, to when did the act occur? So the Supreme Court has indicated to us in Title IX, and then when we combine that with the Rotisky case that we cited in our brief in 2019, that the Supreme Court is looking askance at the discovery rule. And then we look at this court's decision in the Dibrel case in a 1983 action, which has begun to question the discovery rule and whether it's appropriate and proper.
Didn't we hold in Bishop that the discovery rule applies in Title IX cases?
No, Your Honor, I believe you did not. I believe you held that it was the cause of injury and the injury and the cause of injury under the discovery rule, which what triggers a 1983 claim.
Mm-hmm.
So the cause of injury here was Dr. Strauss's conduct. That Supreme Court also...
That was the cause of the tort injury, right?
No, Your Honor. That was that for purposes of accrual. And this court has said repeatedly that it's the abuse that sets the clock ticking. The Supreme Court, more importantly, has taught us under Rotella versus Wood that what sets the clock ticking is the discovery of the injury, not the elements of the claim. And so we're conflating the elements of the claim and what must be proved, what must be alleged and shown, with what starts the clock ticking. Every court we can find in this circuit and at the trial court below has said it's the sexual abuse act or the deprivation of educational benefits and privileges. That goes back to my contract statement about what the Supreme Court said in the Cummings case.
Well, of course, the plaintiffs also alleging fraudulent concealment for some of these victims, claiming that the reason it wasn't known was that the university covered it up and did so deliberately and maliciously.
Well, let me take that in two steps, Your Honor, if I might. First of all, with respect to covering it up, they have alleged that they had a complete and present cause of action in the allegations in their complaint. They have alleged that it was well known throughout Ohio State at the time, as Your Honor, Judge Moore indicated.
Well, in the athletic department, but if it was well known throughout Ohio State, the news would have found its way into the newspapers and the media, which it didn't.
Well, the media is not Ohio State, but they allege extensively that it was known throughout all the sports teams, all the athletic directors, among the persons at Ohio State, the faculty, the staff, the athletic directors. The extensive
But they're saying it wasn't known, and maybe this is a contradiction, but they're also saying that it wasn't known among the student athletes themselves. They also say that if you really want to tell the whole truth.
Actually, Your Honor, they don't. They allege in their complaint that it was known by all of the student athletes. Dr. Strauss's inappropriate touching was a frequent topic of discussion and well known among Ohio State's trainers, coaches, and athletic directors.
No, when I say it was known, it wasn't known that Dr. Strauss's behavior constituted sexual abuse. That's different from being squeamish or thinking that the doctor was behaving arguably, perhaps inappropriately. That's different from them knowing that as a matter of law, the actions constituted sexual abuse. That's an added layer.
No, Your Honor. Let me go back to the one question you asked me, though. They said it was broadly known, and that older students told younger students to watch out, that student athletes informed Ohio State athletic administrators and staff, that Strauss's unorthodox touching during medical exams was such common knowledge that the OSU coaching staff, trainers, and student athletes knew him as Dr. Jellypaws, Dr. Nuts, Dr. Soft Hands, and Dr. Cough, names that reflect his sexual predation. That's their allegation in this complaint at paragraph 196. And we must look to the allegations of the plaintiffs in this case to determine whether the cause of action accrued 20 to 40 years ago. It did.
Did they know? Did they know that the key powers in Ohio State University knew about this and were ignoring this and not pursuing looking into what Dr. Strauss was doing, and in fact were promoting Dr. Strauss, were doing all the things that your opponent has listed in terms of covering up, shredding files, etc.?
For purposes of this issue of accrual, they have alleged that they did.
Where did they allege that they knew of that?
They alleged the things I have been reading to you about Dr. Strauss's inappropriate examinations were well known and discussed openly by OSU administrators and staff at paragraph 198 in the Snyder Hill case and paragraph 139 in the Moxley case. Students and OSU staff complained about Dr. Strauss for decades. So all of the allegations there, and Your Honor, if they did not allege that, according to what I've heard here today from them, then their case would be dismissible because it doesn't allege a full and complete cause of action. And yet they say they do. They have admitted that all of these things occurred at the time. And if it doesn't, then they have pled themselves out of the case. I do want to go back, though. The allegations here, Your Honor, about whether they knew it was sex abuse or not to discover it, they said that and alleged in this case that Strauss made them feel horrible, violated, shocked, horrified, terrified, disgusted, uncomfortable, humiliated, embarrassed, distressed, stunned, and confused during his exams. They said his conduct was, this is his conduct, was sexually suggestive, sexual, inappropriate, creepy, strange, intrusive, unwelcome, egregious, unnerving.
Because conceivably they didn't all respond or think in the same way about the alleged abuse, and no description of response or reaction to it would be attributable to all of the alleged victims. So who are you saying that they're quoting there?
That's quoting the allegations of the complaint about the plaintiffs.
And those allegations purportedly pertain to all of the plaintiffs, is that what you're
all
saying?
All the plaintiffs, plus the plaintiffs collectively alleged that Strauss sexually assaulted, abused, molested, and or harassed plaintiffs between 1979 and 1998 by, and I quote, fondling their testicles and penises, masturbating them to erection and ejaculation, drugging and anally raping them, digitally penetrating their rectums, touching their bodies in other inappropriate ways, making inappropriate comments about their bodies, and asking improper sexualized questions. That comes from their second amended complaint, paragraphs 2-3, and the amended complaint in the Moxley case at paragraphs 2-3. They also allege that Strauss preyed on them, on the male students, by voyeuring, fondling, groping, sexually assaulting, abusing, harassing, and raping them. And under Iqbal Twombly, when you read those allegations and you apply your judicial experience and your common sense, in an objective way, it is not plausible that those allegations in this complaint before this court and the trial court below do not constitute allegations sufficient to put them on notice for purposes of discovery, of the discovery rule, inquiry notice, and likewise do not constitute allegations of sex abuse for purposes of the occurrence rule.
But they knew that nothing was being done by the university vis-a-vis Strauss.
They knew that was deliberate. They were being deliberate and different to all their complaints. Correct, Your Honor. They also knew that at the time. That is exactly right, and they allege that here. They allege they did that they knew nothing was happening, and it was continuing on 20 to 40 years ago.
And so what do they allege was the knowledge of Ohio State at the time before these events happened? They allege that Ohio State knew that there was complete and utter misbehavior by Strauss and did nothing in response except to cover it up.
They allege, Your Honor, that Ohio State knew, and they allege that Ohio State allowed it to continue. And they allege it in this complaint, and they say that their educational experiences were permeated by a sexually hostile culture and environment at Ohio State. So they knew that their Title IX injury was accruing because they were being denied the benefits of their education and opportunities under Title IX. They knew it was because of sex discrimination. They knew it was because of Strauss. They knew that Strauss was employed at Ohio State. They knew they were telling folks about it and it was still continuing on. They knew it was pervasive and they knew it was affecting them. Some of them, and you can look at the compilation of what they did, some of them left the sports teams, some of them left the university, some of them decided that they were going to pursue an athletic career. So they also make all of those allegations of the impact it had on them, but they allege in common that it was so permeating, so pervasive, that it denied them of the benefits of their education. That comes from the complaint. And we must accept that as true under Iqbal and Twombly, and the trial court did that. And as a result, under Iqbal and Twombly, accepting their pleadings as true, it was there, it was real, they knew about it, they had a complete and present cause of action under the occurrence rule, they knew about the discovery rule.
For example, the plaintiff who says that he told the trainers, et cetera, about the misconduct of Strauss and was told, don't report this, bad things will happen to you. He didn't know enough at that point in time to assert his claims. He didn't know that the university had already had reports about Strauss and was doing nothing about those. How do you deal with that, Your Honor?
First, if he confronted a coach and a coach told him that, then deliberate indifference is stated right in the complaint. The coach, according to his own allegations, was being deliberately indifferent to him and his individual circumstance. In terms of the knowledge, they allege the knowledge in the complaint in common allegations. The problem with common allegations is they apply to all the plaintiffs. All of the plaintiffs, these common allegations apply to. And you can't escape them and say, well, we made the common allegations to everybody but number 7, or number 11, or number 12, they apply to all. And yet when you look at the individual allegations, 3,353 paragraphs, when you look at the individual allegations that are there, they likewise are alleging the effect on them, what they knew at the time, and what was being done about it. The question goes back to, though, the accrual. It is not the complete knowledge of all of the causes of action and all of the elements of the cause of action. It put them on inquiry notice, and they should have, as the U.S. Supreme Court said, even in complicated cases of proof like RICO, medical malpractice, the Supreme Court has said you have an obligation at that point when you're on notice to consult with doctors, consult with lawyers. So the Supreme Court has told us what, under an objective accrual rule, someone faced with these alleged activities should have done at the time. Let me go back also to this.
Before you do that, let me just ask you this question.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
When I asked your opponent about the obvious knowledge that the whole athletic department had, his response was that coaches don't count. They're not officials of the university, so it doesn't matter what they know. What's your response to that?
My response to that is coaches do count. Athletic directors count, administrators count, the head of the student health center counts. All of those persons were at levels to deal with that. They have extensive allegations not only about the coaches and the athletic directors, but also about Dr. Grace, who was heading the student health center. Mr. Snyder-Hill specifically complained to him directly to Dr. Strauss. I mean, about Dr. Strauss. He actually went to the head of the Student Health Center, Dr. Grace, and he had a meeting with him, Your Honor. And they had a meeting with Strauss present, and Mr. Snyder-Hill brought his boyfriend as a witness, and they confronted Strauss, and Strauss screamed to him in front of Dr. Grace and Dr. Doucette, who was there as well from the Student Health Center, and he alleges in this complaint that the university, the head of the Student Health Center, did nothing that made him feel he had complete results. He did nothing that resolved his concerns. And so I say to you, when you're saying that a doctor at the Student Health Center was at issue and nobody high up knew, the director of the Student Health Center was in a direct meeting with Mr. Snyder-Hill. As for the coaches, Your Honor, the athletic directors, I dare say that those persons were certainly in a place of responsibility and reporting and diligence. And so those persons likewise would have been at the level that they should have been informing and
yet,
should have been doing what
them,
they...
Yet none of them did.
They alleged that none of them did. That's correct, right. Your Honor. That's the allegation in this case.
Right. We're looking at the allegations in the complaint. And the allegations are that none of them did. And the allegations are that the university continued to promote Strauss, shredded his personnel file, and gave him emeritus status at the end. And after he retired or left the university, the university continued to send him students.
So, Your Honor, once again, I understand, to use Judge Guy's term, your reaction to what Judge Guy has described as egregious. I'm looking at, if it's so egregious, if it was so obvious, if all of the elements were present at the time, and they've alleged they were for the occurrence rule, if all of them were present, don't you think that would at least be, for purposes of the discovery accrual rule, enough to put the plaintiffs on notice that they should be inquiring about what is occurring to them, how it's making them feel, what it's making them do in terms of denying them their educational benefits? It's creating a hostile environment. Now, you either have a hostile environment or you don't have a hostile environment. So was it hostile at the time and they knew it? And so they were on inquiry notice? Or was it not hostile at the time? And so they didn't know it. And so therefore it wasn't hostile because it didn't do anything to them. The problem-
Counsel, some of the plaintiffs were minors and some were adults. Is it your thinking that the same rules apply to plaintiffs who were minors as that would apply to the adults?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not aware of a minor in these cases. And in this case,
you
these two appeals before you are not aware.
Everybody was over 18.
Everybody was over 18. We're not talking about minors. We're talking about student athletes at a university or other students who were enrolled at the university who went to the Student Health Center.
So nobody was 17 or anything like that.
No, Your Honor, not in these cases. And if I'm wrong, I'm sure Mr. Mazzell will correct me, but I'm not. I know there was one in another case who was attending a summer wrestling camp.
So, all right.
But we don't have a doctor preying on minors. We have, and by the way, these athletes, it's replete, again, in their allegations. They are examined and examined and examined again. They have been their entire careers, whether in high school, junior high. These are high, elite, top-notch, world-class athletes. They know what a physical exam is like. They've been examined throughout. They knew it was different with Strauss. They knew it was wrong. They knew it was sexual. One of the persons actually said in this case that it was like his first sexual experience. That's how graphic it was that what happened. So when you go through the allegations, and by the way, I want to say to help the court, I noticed that they singled out in their briefing that there are 11 plaintiffs who they say were such that that they were the ones that they would want to point out that they did not know they were being sexually abused. I went back and looked at the 11 that they singled out, 7 in the Snyder-Hill case, and 4 in the Moxley case. And if you read the graphic statements that they put in their allegations in this complaint, it is incomprehensible, but more importantly, from the standpoint of the Supreme Court, it is not plausible that these persons were not at least on inquiry notice to determine that their rights were being violated and what they could do about it. There's a Mr. Wells here, and I apologize for using names, but he is named here as opposed to John Doe. He said that he was having pain in his hamstring, and Strauss started the exam by rubbing his torso and buttocks. Wells thought the manner which Taos was rubbing him was strange. Wells had a hamstring injury before, and other medical professionals had never rubbed him in that way. Wells felt that Dr. Strauss was rubbing him in a sexual way. And the list goes on. He says he never sought treatment from him again. I don't want to read it all, but there are 11 of them. And when you go back and read those 11 as the best examples they have, Your Honor, the best examples they have that I didn't know anything was going on, I didn't know it was different, every single one of them alleges that same kind of act. He went,
Your best case to say that they had a duty to exercise their inquiry notice here by further investigation?
I would say in this circuit, it would be the Guy case versus Fayette County. And I would say that the reason I say that, it was a 1983 case, but there the same kinds of things were occurring, and they said that they had to find out about the deliberate indifference and so forth. And this court said that they were on inquiry notice. The Gilley case, Your Honor, another Sixth Circuit opinion, this court held, because there, in that instance, and I just want to tell you the facts, in that instance, the plaintiff was sleeping with her high school coach, but she said, I didn't know that was sexual abuse. And the court, this court said, under fraudulent concealment or otherwise, you were on inquiry notice and you should have gone and investigated. Sleeping with your coach probably should have put you on notice as a high school student in that instance that something wasn't right. So those would be the two. But I look at the Giffen case this court decided, the Adams case that came out of the Southern District of Ohio, the Forrester case in the Eastern District of Michigan, the Doe versus University of Tennessee case from the Middle District of Tennessee, the Anderson versus Board of Education of Fayette County case, the Eastern District of Kentucky.
So the last four cases are all district cases.
They are.
But so that, in terms of this circuit, you've mentioned Guy, Gilley, and Giffen.
Correct, Your Honor. I apologize. I was on a roll there and reading from my list, but those are the ones from this circuit. So to take this discovery rule and to take away the sex abuse as the triggering act, or to take away the deprivation.
And were those three cases applying the discovery rule?
No, all those were applying, the Gilley case got to the discovery rule because the plaintiff said that she didn't know sleeping with her coach was sex abuse. So the Gilley case approached it from that standpoint and said, look, even if we apply the discovery rule, you should have known that to be on inquiry notice that that was sex abuse. Your Honors.
So your opponents listed a number of circuits that they say support their position, and Ouellette is the primary one that they're discussing, but they mentioned a number of other cases. How do you distinguish Ouellette?
Well, Ouellette was a 1983 case. There were not the extensive allegations of knowledge of what was occurring at the time. It was a single plaintiff and one other single act. So here we know, because of the common allegations under Ouellette, we know that Ouellette did not involve those kinds of allegations of knowledge at the time of the acts and what the acts were doing to each other and to all of them. The complaint here did that. The other thing I will say about Ouellette, it is an outlier in the First Circuit. I can tell you that in the Second Circuit in the Tversky case, in the Fifth Circuit under the King-White case, in the Tenth Circuit under Varnell, in the Seventh Circuit under Doe versus Howe, in the Ninth Circuit under Samuelson versus Oregon State, it was when the injury occurred, that was the triggering event that started the clock running. And that's just like what the Supreme Court has taught us in Rotella versus Wood, when the injury occurred, not when you had a full and complete cause of action and knew everything about it, it's when the injury occurred, they knew the injury had occurred, they knew that Strauss had done it, they knew that Strauss was employed at Ohio State. For institutional responsibility, that knowledge was important to them, and they were on inquiry notice to begin inquiring and doing the investigation. Your Honor, Judge Moore, you pointed out that in April 2018, the Perkins Coie engagement was announced, and within 2 months after that, plaintiffs were already bringing their lawsuits here. So I dare say that it was not very long, it didn't take very long to investigate, to speak to their clients, to do the interviews that lawyers all do to meet Rule 11, that they were able to bring the lawsuit, at least in the Snyder Hill case, within approximately, it was July of 2018 that case was first brought. So I think it's disingenuous to say that they couldn't have done the investigation. They clearly could have. They're very fine lawyers on the other side, and they clearly could have done that.
How long is the statute of limitations?
2 years, Your Honor, 2305.10A. And I want to tell you, I know that we look to federal law for when the accrual rule begins, but do you know under 2305.10A, as I was looking last night, Ohio's statute of limitations, the two-year statute, says that it accrues when the injury occurs. So they use the word occurrence right in the state statute as well. So I would urge the court to look at that as well. I see my time is up. We would ask the court to affirm the decision below. It was correct. We do so with the understanding that we have tried to resolve these cases. And I understand, Your Honor, it's the University of today that's doing it, but I want publicly to tell you that that is the first step in reconciliation and the healing process. We have settled with 296 plaintiffs for $60 million. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you sit down,
Just a curiosity question.
Because of the way this was collectively pleaded, if this statute of limitations is reversed and this case goes to trial, is it a one wins and they all win, or one loses and they all loses, or do they have to look at all of these plaintiffs separately?
I suppose it depends on how the case is tried and how is it addressed, Your Honor. I haven't really got to the point of figuring out how you would try, in this instance, 84 plus 24, so there's 108 plaintiffs in one trial. But if we did try them, I would think probably 104 of them would be witnesses, as would the others in the other cases, and the trial would be what they all knew at the time and what they were all relating to each other at the time to show that the statute of limitations defense was still viable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
There's a lot to cover in 7 minutes. I'm very surprised they brought up settlement in a appellate proceeding, obviously of no relevance here, and I don't even want to discuss how paltry their offers are compared to every other university. Unfortunately, the University of today is the same as the University of 40 years ago, but that's neither here nor there to this question. To answer your question, Judge Moore, Wallace did not discuss whether the discovery rule applies in Section 1983. It just adds nothing to this analysis. The Cummings case, which they raised for the very first time, never put that in a brief, never in a supplemental letter. It's utterly irrelevant to this appeal. They haven't dealt with Petrovsky, didn't deal with it today, didn't deal with it in their papers.
They what about these 3G cases, Guy, Gillis, or...
Sure.
Gilly and Griffin.
So, Giffen, unpublished case, no analysis really in that case at all, no discussion at all whether the discovery rule applies. It really doesn't help them. Gilly didn't discuss the discovery rule at all. It discussed tolling for fraudulent concealment under Kentucky law. That's just not before this court. Guy was a case where the parties, for some reason, decided that Kentucky law defined the accrual of a federal claim, and the court accepted that invitation and relied on, you know, Kentucky law instead of federal law, which is plainly wrong. I mean, there's no other court in the Sixth Circuit anywhere else that's done that. So none of those courts cases are, you know, I'm afraid, on point in this proceeding where we're discussing the discovery.
So his basic point is that they... plaintiffs were on inquiry notice that they should have inquired. How do you address that?
Right. And so two points there. The first is, again, they use a blunderbuss approach for the plaintiffs. Many of them were not athletes. They didn't know about nicknames. You know, they just had different experiences with Strauss, and all they knew was their own experience. And they were not on inquiry notice as to what OSU knew or what OSU's response was. But second, inquiry notice is not enough. Ouellette and this court in the New England Healthcare case, which the Rain brief cited, held that it's not enough to just have a suspicion as to causation. It's the plaintiffs would have had to uncover sufficient information to allow them to bring a claim, which they cannot do, Ouellette tells us, if a defendant takes steps to cover up its involvement. And that is this case. There is no way that any of these plaintiffs could have discovered that OSU administrators had knowledge or were deliberately indifferent. And to answer Your question, Judge Guy, again, my adversary says coaches don't count. I'm sorry, he says coaches do count for purpose of notice. This court in Kesterson, 967 F3rd at 528, held squarely that in a Title IX case, a varsity softball coach does not count for notice purposes. So whatever coaches knew, whatever plaintiffs knew, the coaches knew, utterly irrelevant under this, under the controlling case law in the Sixth Circuit. And I just want to point out, they cited paragraph 198 as somehow evidence that the plaintiffs knew all along that administrators were on notice. Paragraph 198 says, quote, Dr. Strauss's inappropriate examinations were well known and discussed openly by OSU administrators and staff. That's true, and we know that now. We know that now in 2022. We didn't, no one knew that back in the 1970s or the 1980s. There's no allegation that the plaintiffs knew that. We know that after OSU hired a law firm, spent over $6 million, interviewed hundreds of people to determine that. Even their own brief in opposition, very interesting, page 3 of their brief, says, quote, in 2018, OSU was, quote, determined to learn what university leaders at the time may have known. They're determined to learn that in 2018 because they didn't know it. And if they didn't know it in 2018, how on earth do students and teenagers know that in the 1980s and 1990s? As to the question of, you know, did they know they were sexually abused? Unfortunately, OSU has taken a blunderbuss approach to your question, Judge Clay. Different plaintiffs had different experiences. Unfortunately, there were a couple who were raped. They are not alleging that they didn't know they were sexually abused. There were others where Dr. Strauss, you know, held their genitals for what seemed like a prolonged period of time. They didn't know that was sexual abuse. So it's a blunderbuss strategy by OSU. Unfortunately, it was the same ruling by the district court. Didn't look at any of the individual allegations. Didn't parse them at all. And that's something this court could do, doesn't need to do, because we don't get to the question of whether plaintiffs knew they were sexually abused, because all of them, as a threshold matter, had no idea that the administration of OSU was on notice and that they had a deliberately indifferent response. And that is why they really have been utterly unable to distinguish the Ouellette case. Don't even mention the Petrovsky case in the Fifth Circuit. Don't mention the Barrett case in the Second Circuit. All of these cases where the plaintiffs didn't have notice as to that particular defendant's culpability or involvement. I want to close with a couple of points, and that is that at the end of the day, this court held in the Cutter case and in Henry Artic, that what plaintiffs knew or should have known is a fact question. We have not had discovery. We're at a motion to dismiss. They are trying on a motion to dismiss to sustain a very high burden of proving an affirmative defense, taking every inference in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and avoiding any discovery as to what a plaintiff should or should not have known. In the Petrovsky case, there was a jury interrogatory on this question, and the Fifth Circuit held that there was sufficient evidence to support what the jury found as to knowledge or what they should have known. That is this case, too. These are fact questions. They should go to discovery. If they are able somehow in discovery to show that some plaintiff knew that the general counsel or vice president was aware of the sexual abuse and did nothing, more power to them. I'm sure we'll be back here in summary judgment for that hypothetical plaintiff. I don't think discovery is going to bear that out for a single plaintiff, not even one. But that's not where we are now. We're just at a motion to dismiss. Finally, briefly, there are two minors, JD 49 and 47, Judge. It is 4 years to the day that this case was filed. 4 years to the day. And we're still at the motion to dismiss stage. After, 20 to 40 years after this sexual abuse.
So has there been any discovery?
The court below allowed 6 depositions for the purpose of aiding mediation. And we incorporated the results of those depositions into our amended complaint. But of course, there are many, many depositions to go. We haven't had document discovery. There is much to learn in this case. And finally, after 4 years, Judge Moore and Clay and Guy, thank you very much for your time today. It is time finally to get to discovery. It is finally time to move this case forward. These plaintiffs, these students, these survivors have suffered enough over 40 years of concealment and lies and obfuscation, and now 4 years of stonewalling us in this case. It is time to move this case forward. Thank you, Judge.
One last question. Are you saying by what you most recently said that If you win this case, the issue of statute of limitations is nonetheless still alive?
Yes. Yes. They in discovery, can probe what plaintiffs knew or should have known, plaintiff by plaintiff, and we'll see where discovery leads. And again, we are at the motion to dismiss stage. They have summary judgment available to them if they have the evidence. I don't think they will, but they do have that opportunity. And yes, Judge, that's exactly
right.
Thank you both for your argument, and the case will be submitted.